I'm going to speak about some experimental results that we've been doing over the past few months, working on discontinuous ferromagnetic materials and looking at the glassy properties of those. So this was work done at Bar Ilan. This is the student, Ariel Eisenbach, which did the experiment together with me. And I'll show you results. We don't really have explanations for them. We don't understand, but I guess that's why we're here. And another note is that I'm going to give a kind of a shorter version of this talk in the conference. So those of you who are here are exempt from that talk in the conference. Anyway, so we've heard quite a lot during this program here about the different systems that have shown properties of electron glasses. And here's, I think, most of the list of these materials. And basically, what people have been seeing experimentally are these slow relaxations, very, very long times, and all kinds of aging effects, which are typical to all kinds of glasses. But maybe the hallmark of an electronic glass is this memory dip, which is really the fingerprint of something which is intrinsically electronic. And these have been seen only in systems that, in these kinds of systems. And I'm going to show today results on a different system, which we've been looking at, and that is granular nickel, or more exactly, discontinuous films of nickel, where the granular material, the little grains, also have a magnetic moment. And the question that we're going to ask is whether these magnetic properties of the grains are going to influence the electronic glass, the properties of the electronic glass, basically the things that we see here. Now, studying another material, specifically nickel, is, can be interesting for a number of reasons. It's another material to add to this list. Already?
Yeah. I haven't said about it. This list, the lead, bismuth, and beryllium are all these quench condensed things which are very inhomogeneous? Or?
So I don't know what you call inhomogeneous, but.
I mean, almost granular, or would you not call it?
I don't know. The claim is, the people that produced it, it's Alan Goldman basically, and he tried to make them uniform, but how uniform they are. But definitely, beryllium is uniform. Not uniform, but it is continuous. This is something that Zvi measured over the, lately. Indium oxide is not granular. Okay? First of all, a number of points I want to make about nickel. There was a claim in the past that maybe all of this electronic glass comes from superconductivity, except for this granular gold. All of the other materials have some kind of superconductivity in them. Nickel definitely doesn't. So if nickel shows electronic glass, that is a system that is not superconducting. And another thing about the way we grow the nickel is that we kind of avoid oxides. I'll talk about it soon. This is a sample which is oxide-free. And unlike many of these cases where there's a lot of oxide inside, so this also prevents some ideas that were raised in the past about movement of oxides being in charge of all of this electronic behavior. So, granular nickel is interesting in these cases and for these reasons. And basically, the main reason we're trying to study it is to try to see whether the ferromagnetism that is inherent in nickel affects the electronic glasses. So I've put a star on these three materials because these are the three materials that have been studied the most. So there's a lot of data about the dynamics of these. And everything that I'm going to show in granular nickel, I'm going to compare to these three materials. So this was measured mainly in Ovdiao's group. And this is the Grenoble people who had a lecture here before I came talking about granular aluminum. And I'm going to compare results on nickel to these systems. OK, so let's start with the way we grow these samples. It's quench condensed.
Just to understand, so if there is no oxide, what separates the grains in nickel?
Vacuum. And I'll talk about it in a second. It's a discontinuous film of nickel.
Ah, so two-dimensional.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the way this is done is by the technique of quench condensation. What we start is with an insulating substrate, which has a gate, a metallic gate on one side. and two electrons, a source and a drain, on the other side. We place this sample.
What is this insulated?
It's silicon oxide, half a micron. We place this sample on kind of a sample holder, which is placed in a vacuum can, and all of this vacuum can is immersed in liquid helium. So there's good vacuum in this region. Everything sits at low temperatures. And at this cryogenic temperatures, we grow very, very thin layers of nickel on this substrate here. Okay, so if the sample is thin enough, it goes as a discontinuous sample, a two-dimensional granular sample. Okay, so what we have here is a sample which is grown at very, very high vacuum. So we assume that if there's any oxide here, it's really minimal. It allows us a very, very good control over the resistance, the conductance of the sample, because since everything is done at very, very cold temperatures, we can stop the evaporation, the deposition of the material at any point we want, and everything freezes and basically hardly moves. So you can really, really control the amount of disorder, the amount of resistance that you want in the sample. The sample is pretty clean as far as oxide is concerned, and everything is done at low temperatures. So we don't recycle, we don't heat up, we leave everything in vacuum, and this is the way the sample is gone.
And the oxide is the substrate, you're not worried
about? A bit.
It's oxide as well, right?
Yes, so oxides can come from the substrate.
And tunneling can go through
definitely.
Substrate, not
yes.
Through vacuum.
Yes. Definitely. But that is a substrate matter. Okay, so now before I get to the glassy behavior of these materials, I want to spend some time on just the normal magnetotransport, because this will be important to understand what we're seeing, the dynamics. Let's just look at conductivity for the time being, and basically the magnetoconductivity, the magnetoresistance of the sample. And all of these are ferromagnetic granular samples, or discontinuous samples. The magnetoresistance has a maximum of resistance, which kind of levels off at some kind of saturation magnetization. And the reason for this negative magnetoresistance, this is a hallmark of a granular ferromagnet. It is not seen in samples which are non-ferromagnetic. The reason is that the hopping, tunneling between different grains depends also on the magnetic moment of each of these grains. Each of the grains has a magnetic moment. It has an easy axis. At zero magnetic field, the magnetic moments of these grains are random in space. So we have a maximum in the resistance. The resistance is a function of the angle between these magnetic moments, and so when we apply a magnetic field, we align all the spins in the direction of the magnetic field. Tunneling or hopping becomes easier between the grains, and we have a negative magnetoresistance.
At small fields, is it ferromagnet or superparamagnet?
So that's a good point. I will show we have both of the cases. In this case, it's just a superparamagnet, and that's the reason why the peak of the resistance is at H equals zero. If it was a ferromagnet, it wouldn't be, and that is exactly what we do when we couple the grains more and more. So we can take this system and grow minuscule amounts of material coupled between the grains, and indeed, as Boris implied, what we see is a transition from a behavior where we have a peak at zero magnetic field to a behavior where we have a hysteresis. So these, we're going in this direction, and these curves are a sweep going in this direction, and then a sweep coming back in this direction, and we see a splitting of the peak. We see a hysteresis in the magnetoresistance, which tells us that the samples are becoming ferromagnetic. And the explanation for this is based on the crossover from a superparamagnetic behavior to a ferromagnetic behavior. So just a few words about that. Each one of the grains has some kind of easy axis for magnetization. It might be the shape of the grain, it can be related to the environment, it can be related to the crystalline anisotropy, but there is some kind of an isotropy which determines some kind of barrier for flipping the spin from one easy axis to another easy axis. As long as the grain is large enough or the temperature low enough, we have a ferromagnetic behavior. The spin is pinned to one of the easy axes. But now, if we take the grain and we make it smaller and smaller, this energy barrier becomes smaller because it is because it depends on the volume of the grain. And at some point at a finite temperature, we cross over to what is called a superpower magnetic behavior, where the temperature is large enough to overcome this barrier. And then, even though the grains are, you know, ferromagnetic in the sense that all of the spins in a grain point to the same direction, but over time they just flip their direction. And so over time, average over time, there is no magnetization in the system. This is what is called superpower magnetism. You can cross over from one behavior to the other either by making the grain smaller, decreasing the voltage, the volume, sorry, or by decreasing temperature. So in this case, what we are doing is we are adding more material, we are coupling between the grains. The grains on the average are becoming larger and larger, and we're crossing over from a superpower magnetic behavior to a ferromagnetic behavior. We can do the same thing by temperature. So here's an example for a temperature. At 20 degrees Kelvin, you can hardly see any hysteresis in the behavior. And as we decrease the temperature, a hysteresis develops until it becomes at 4 degrees, it becomes pretty large. So here we are seeing again a crossover from a superparamagnetic array to a ferromagnetic array as a function of temperature, and the blocking temperature in all of our systems obviously depends on the coupling between the grains, but is about 20 degrees, between 30 degrees and 15 degrees. So these are the temperatures that we're going to talk about. Yes.
But here you're only talking about a single grain is locked, and the global ordering temperature is irrelevant?
It might be very relevant, and that's a very good point. I'll talk about that.
And is it lower than this?
I think we have signs that it's lower. I'll show you the data, and we can decide.
Still, just to make sure, each grain has its own easy axis.
Yes.
So if there is no coupling within the grain, by the time you get to temperature smaller than what you call KV,
like within the grain, there's always coupling. You mean between two grains?
Well, each grain is aligned, but it can be aligned on the easy axis or an arbitrary axis.
No, it cannot.
It depends on the total isotopy.
No, that depends. First of all, there's a Curie temperature, which is above. That's in the sky. Below that Curie temperature, all of the spins in the grain, there's interactions within a grain. They are all aligned in the same direction.
The question is in which direction?
Well, so the temperature flips them over between easy axes.
But if the isotopy is too small, they don't care about the easy axis, and they can go around.
Yes, they can. Right, and that is the case where you don't have any spontaneous magnetization, and what we see in the experiment is maximum resistance at zero magnetic field. Once you apply a magnetic field, you force them to align with the magnetic field, and you see this negative magneto resistance.
Right? But that's only if the easy axis, x psi, are more or less parallel to each other. Otherwise, it would be a random anisotropy problem.
Yes, you can have
complicated.
Yes, but you overcome this random anisotropy with high enough magnetic field.
Yes.
Okay.
So sure. Not just by exchange between the grains.
No.
Or would it be that the magnetic field can flip the sign but within the axis?
It could be.
Axis.
It could be if
it makes it favorable by choosing one of the best options.
Yes. So that depends on the anisotropy of the problem.
Yeah.
As
that sounds more like a discontinuous thing, like you're getting.
Right. And we don't know if that is the case. We don't think that is the case in our. Okay. We do see some kind of smooth behavior that can be because of a distribution of sizes of the grains, but it can also be because of. Yes.
Why is the size of the effect is 0.5%? Right?
Yes. So this is a good point. The size of the effect is small. It's very small. On the scale of conductivity here, which is hopping conductivity or changes in temperature, for example, from here to here. You know, this is a minute effect. We're changing the resistance by an order of magnitude. And the magneto resistance is only 0.5%. But the 0.5% is because of the randomization of the grains. And we don't get more than that in these systems. But even this 0.5% is something which is specific to ferromagnetism. When we do the same thing on silver, for example, we don't see it.
So magnetic field of 2 Tesla or something, it doesn't align the spin here.
No. And that is a so that's a good point. I don't know how we want to go into all of these details, but this is something which is specific to very small grains, which have a lot of spins on the surface. And the spins on the surface kind of tend to arrange themselves in some kind of spin glass or spin wave or something like that, which is much harder to align than the bulk spins. But, you know, that is something which is probably not related to what we have here. Yes?
Our experiment, does magnetar resistance depend on the rotation of the magnetic field with respect to the spin?
So this is something that I hope I will be able to answer in a few months. So far, we've been only been able to apply the magnetic field parallel, perpendicular to the substrate. And that might be a good point, and I'll talk about it, because probably the results, the way we understand them today, depend on that. And now we're in the process of building a new experimental setup, which I hope will allow us to rotate in the field. Right now we could not do it. Okay, just a few more points before we get to dynamics. One of them is this. So this is a sample that what I've explained up to now is that this peak in the magneto resistance is the point at which the magnetic moments are random in space. And this should correlate to a state of zero magnetization. Okay, this is the point where we have maximum randomization, so zero magnetization. This is a sample that we prepared in a different way so that we could take it out of the system and put it in a squid and measure magnetization. So it's kind of a different, I can't compare anything about this sample to the ones that we quench condensed, but just to see the behavior, we compared the magneto resistance to a magnetization measurement. And what you see in this sample, you expect the peak to be the same as the point of zero magnetization, but it is not. The peak is always, in these samples, larger. The magnetic field at which we see a peak in the resistance is always larger than the zero magnetization. And this kind of is obvious if you think about it. This just tells us or shows us another sign for the fact that the resistance is not an average measurement. It does not probe the entire sample. It probes just a percolation backbone of a granular sample, and obviously it will tend to go to grains which are larger than the average because of charging energies. So this is a much more average measurement. This is a measurement that shows us that hopping would prefer to go through larger grains on the average. And so this will come up later. And one more point is just to notice that the difference between the virgin curve and the curve after we've applied magnetic field. And this will be very important. So here I'm showing these curves. Blue is a sweep going in this way, red is a sweep going in this way. But when we prepare the sample, before the first time we apply the magnetic field, the resistance, the curve will look like this. So at zero magnetic field, when we just prepared the sample, you expect the sample to be as random as it could be. I mean, naively you would expect it to be as high as this, but it is not. And apparently, even though it's random, there's different degrees of randomness. You can have random moments within the plane of your sample, and then even though it's random, you have different angles, you know, random angles between the grains. But when we apply a perpendicular magnetic field and align the spins out of the field, the randomness is between spin up and spin down, and this has a much larger effect on conductivity. Okay?
Is here any difference between field pool and zero field pool?
No. We haven't seen a difference.
And these spins, are they in plane or which way are they pointing?
What I try to draw here is spins going out of the plane. Because magnetic field is applied perpendicular to the field, perpendicular to the plane of the,
without
the sample.
Field.
Without the field, I'm imagining that the easy accesses are in the plane.
In the plane?
Yep.
Oh, okay. So that will explain why the
jet is small, right? Yes? Mm-hmm. Right. That is one of the reasons why it's small. There's a few others.
One more question. These windows, which are small, are they reproducible or just
noise? No, it's noise. It's noise. Granular samples on the whole have a pretty large noise, and on these small, this is a pretty small effect. So, okay, so I think we're ready now to switch gears and look at the glassy behavior and on the dynamics and on the memories.
And temperature depends on conductivity.
Okay. Unfortunately, I don't have a curve here, but these samples show as just like other granular systems that we've measured, t to the 1/2, kind of an Efferschlofsky behavior. But with the caveat that we are limited in the temperature range. So our temperature range is somewhere between 4 degrees and 20, 25 degrees. We cannot heat up above this temperature. We cannot go below in this kind of setup. We can't heat up the sample because once we heat up the sample, it breaks up and the sample is destroyed. We have to keep it at low temperature. So the maximum of resistance range that we saw, the t to the 1/2, is about a decade and a half, maybe.
About what?
About 1 or 1.5 orders of magnitude.
Oh, this is the dynamic range of conductivities?
Yes. So t to the 1/2.
And they are quite above E squared over H?
Yes.
The thickness of the sample.
So it's a single layer of grains. Mm-hmm. The average thickness, the nominal thickness that we put down is around 3 nanometers, 30 angstroms. And it breaks up into a discontinuous. Okay, so, on the face of things, this material, just like the other materials I talked about, maybe just like indium oxide, just like granular aluminum, shows slow relaxation. This is just part of a slow relaxation that we see. And more importantly, probably, is this memory dip, which tells us that indeed we are talking about an electron glass, an intrinsic electron glass. It has features which are very, very similar to what people have seen in the past. But now,
there's a magnetic properties does any glass behave?
So this is the reason why I'm talking. I will.
Can you translate the gate voltage into particle per grain?
Into?
An electron per grain, extra
electron. No.
You can in principle, but.
Can do it
later.
If you ask me if I've done it, if I can do it, of course I can do it. But I haven't done that, and if it's important, we'll do it. Okay, but what I want to focus now on, since we want to compare samples and behavior.
There's this gate.
You showed.
Oh, you showed this. Sorry.
No, it's fine. There's a gate underneath.
Underneath also. So, okay.
There's a gate, then there's an insulator, and then we grow the sample.
How thick is insulator?
Half a micron. Okay, so now the main part of what I want to talk about has to do with times. The characteristic time of this slow relaxation. Now, we all know that it looks like it behaves like a log power or very close to a log power, and log doesn't have any time. Any characteristic time. Nevertheless, there's a very large difference between a log that goes like this and a log that goes like this. Somehow we would like to define some time, some measurement time, which tells us something about the slowness of the dynamics here. And there is a difference, especially if you're sitting in the lab, there's a difference between something that takes 20 minutes and something that takes 20 hours. So you would definitely like to define some kind of way to measure the slowness, the time. And some of these ways have, a few ways have been suggested in the past by Tzvi and used in the past by Tzvi, and they all seem to be more or less give the same results. And one of them, which I'm going to use today, is the two-dip experiment. And the two-dip experiment is done in the following way. I'm sure it's been discussed here, but I'll just remind you. What you do is you prepare your sample and you equilibrize it so that you have a well-defined memory dip. The important thing here is to prepare this. If you want to compare samples, so prepare them exactly in the same way and use the same protocol and wait the same times. Okay, so we define some kind of time where we wait for a dip to form. And then, once the dip is formed, we shift the gate voltage at which the dip has formed. So we waited a long time at a gate voltage V number V1 here. And now we shift it to V2 somewhere here, and we watch a new memory dip develop. So with time, what happens is that the initial memory dip is erased, and a new one starts to develop. And we take measurements of these two dips. At some point, the new dip exceeds the old one, and we continue. And you define tau to be the time at which the two dips, the magnitude of the two dips is equal. And this is more or less the time where it takes the first dip to reach half of its value.
So it's in the curve, you're doing it, it's coming quickly.
Yes, very quick compared to anything in the measurements.
But the first dip steps depends on how long you wait.
Right, so yes. But two things you have to take into account. First of all, because of that reason, indeed, it is important to make sure that you prepare the dip for the same times. You wait a long time. We wait about 18 hours before we start. And we wait the same time for each measurement, which I'm going to compare today. And the second thing is that you have to remember is, since everything is logarithmic, so waiting 18 hours or waiting 20 hours or 21 hours is not very different. Okay, at some point, you're right. In principle, theoretically, you're right. So you have to prepare the sample. You have to make sure that samples are prepared in the same way, wait at the same time, and that defines you some kind of backline, of background. Okay, so as I said, in the past, this has been used to measure times. We use the same protocol as what was done by Tzvi for indium oxide samples. And here's just some data from Tzvi. In his data, what you can see is this tau, which is defined in this way, or similar to this way. This is the data for amorphous indium oxide. And you see that these times depend very strongly on the electron concentration. I'm sure you've shown this here, but I'm sure it's been shown here. But for large enough concentration, it seems to saturate at a certain value, and this value is about 1,000 seconds, around 1,000 seconds. Similar things have been seen on granular aluminum, because granular aluminum obviously should be somewhere here, and so should granular lead. And indeed, when we measure at relatively high temperatures, at 10 degrees, this is indeed what we see. So here's the amplitude of the dip for 10 degrees. Of granular aluminum. This is the first dip being destroyed, being raised. This is the second dip being built, being developed. And the times are around 1,000, maybe 1,500 seconds. So the times are comparable to what other people have seen, Tzvi has seen in indium oxide, and what the Grenoble people have seen in aluminum, in granular aluminum.
This is your measurement?
Yes. This is the measurement at 10 degrees Kelvin. However, when we cool the sample down to lower temperatures, we see different times. Before I'll show you that, I'll just mention that for the indium oxide, at least for the very, very high-density indium oxide, and for granular aluminum, there is no temperature, or there's a minimal temperature dependence of these times. When we do the same thing for granular nickel, the time shoots up to somewhere around 6,000 seconds. Okay, so we had 1,000 seconds at 10 degrees, and at 4 degrees we have suddenly a factor of 6 larger, 6,000 seconds. And this is what happens with temperature. So, you know, this might be, you might think that this is the natural way to think about things. When you cool things down, everything slows down. Not so surprising maybe, but just I want to point out two things. First of all, in other systems, similar systems, it has not been seen. It cools.
Time between switching on the second field.
So again, the way we do things is we, first of all, we erase everything. We heat up everything to high temperatures. We erase all the memory up to then. We cool it down and we wait 18 hours for the first bit to develop. Okay. After 18 hours, we switch to a.
Well, what is the time after?
18 hours. So first of all, this is rapid increase in the times has not been seen in other systems. But what's maybe more surprising is the way it depends on temperature. And the way it depends on temperature is something like this. It's pretty flat up to a certain temperature, and then it looks like it shoots up very, very sharply at a specific temperature. And then it levels off again. So all of the temperature dependence happens over a very, very narrow range of temperatures.
And is this temperature reflected in any other quantities, like that features on the average conductivity or
no.
The spectrum of atom of noise or?
Nothing that we've seen so far, except for some magnetic stuff that I'm going to show. This has not been, when you measure RT, you just see this T to the half dependence, and I'm sorry, I don't have the graph here, but nothing special happens at 10 degrees, or nothing that we can measure.
Your time is the same? Or
no, and I'll show that. It depends on the resistivity. The time?
Yes.
The times are the same, but the point at which it jumps from here to here is not the same. Okay, and I'll show that in a second.
So some simple argument to tell you that this time is just this geometric average between the weighting equilibration time and some microscopic
yes, so this might also
time.
Also my point.
Do you think that might be correct?
No, because there's no, this sample and this sample
yes.
Are being made under the same conditions, waiting the same time.
Yeah, but the microscopic time.
Okay, so maybe there's some kind of microscopic time, which I don't know where, at this point we don't know where it comes from. Mm-hmm. Something that happens at this temperature, which affects everything, sure. Okay. That might be
do you think that the tau that you measure is just square root of 18 hours and microscopic?
I don't know. I don't think so, but, let me continue. But the answer is I don't know.
But you know how it depends on the waiting time, and instead of 18, you wait 36 hours?
I don't know. I just know that if we don't wait enough time, so things get mixed up, and we don't want that.
Very last question about that. Is that sensitivity to slip rate for this time?
No. The sweep rate here is, of the order of half a minute, and the times here are of the order of hours.
Yeah, so, I see, but I'm just thinking about square root. What time I would think about sweep rate?
No. Okay, so, it's really pretty amazing. It's a very, very sharp increase. It looks like some kind of transition. And the question is, is why in the first place it happens, and why is it so different than the other materials, indium oxide and granular aluminum, where a lot of stuff has been done, or similar stuff has been done.
Actually, this is the same in the magnetic field
as
without the magnetic field?
No. Different? That's a good question. I'll get to magnetic field. Oh, everything I'm talking about now is at zero field.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to magnetic field.
Have you done magnetic field?
Yes.
Is the time different?
Yes, and I'll show that soon. Let me go step by step.
Okay.
We still have 20 minutes. Okay, so, I cannot rule out at this point that this is coming, that the difference maybe between our material and the other materials is not related to nickel and not related to ferromagnetism. It's somehow related to the fact that we are dealing with a discontinuous film and not a continuous film and not a 3D granular film. Maybe there's some kind of transition which is related to some kind of transition of dielectric constant or polarization or stuff like that. And for that reason, now we're trying to do measurements on other materials, discontinuous materials, which are not ferromagnetic. So this is something that we're doing at this point. I don't have data now, but you know, at this point, it might be related to what I'm showing now. At least the temperature dependence might be related to something different. But the obvious difference, you know, the most obvious difference between these nickel samples and all of the other samples is that this is a ferromagnetic sample. So we might suggest that what we are seeing here, or this transition from one place, from one time to another, might be related to a transition from a superparamagnetic behavior to a ferromagnetic behavior. Okay, that's if we think about grains which which are superparamagnetic, so the magnetic moment is switching fast in space, or in time, sorry, it might be very similar to other systems that don't have any magnetic moment in them. But once we align spins, once the spins are aligned in a certain direction, many of the spins are disaligned one with each other. The transition from one grain to the other becomes more difficult. It affects the conductivity some, but maybe it affects the relaxation a lot. So, you know, one thing to think about here is that we have a magnetic transition from a superparamagnet to a ferromagnet, and this kind of affects the times in the system.
But then this transition is a fact for every individual grain, and there's a distribution. Why should it be between nine?
Okay, that's a great question. So that's one of the reasons why this is problematic in my eyes. And another reason is the fact that this happens at temperatures 10 degrees, which are lower than what we see for when we start seeing the increases in the conductivity. So, you know, you could say that maybe conductivity, and it's true, conductivity is governed by larger grains, and maybe the dynamics or the relaxation is governed by much smaller grains. And I'm sure that's true also. But definitely the fact that it's so sharp in temperature kind of makes this not such a good explanation. But what I can say, so as I said, the blocking temperature in this sample is 22 degrees, and this transition happens at 10 degrees. Not exactly the same. But what we do see, and this is related to a question that was asked, that if we take two samples, or actually we take the same sample and evaporate a bit more and change the resistance by an order of magnitude, you know, this is 300 kiloohms, this is 3 megaohms at 4 degrees, what we see, the times haven't changed. Okay, the high temperature times and the low temperature times are the same, but the temperature at which we see this transition occurring, this sharp transition occurring, depends on the resistance.
Okay. This superpara to ferro transition also changes.
Definitely. So as I say, here the blocking temperature is 17 degrees. Here the blocking temperature is 22 degrees. Definitely, as we increase the coupling between the grains, the resistance goes lower.
So the ratio is more or less the same.
More or less. Or not very different. So this would point to something which is indeed related somehow to this transition. Another possibility that seems more likely to us at this point, and was raised at the beginning of this, is indeed some kind of collective kind of transition, which is related to the intergrain magnetic interactions, dipole-dipole interactions between these grains. And this would really be something that could be sharp. It could be not directly related to the blocking temperature of the superparamagnetic behavior. It has been considered and kind of seen in the past for three-dimensional granular systems. And this would mean that at some temperature, which might be lower than the blocking temperature of each one of the grains, so below the blocking temperature, each grain has a magnetic moment pointed in a certain direction, and then at a lower temperature, there's interaction between the grains, and for a two-dimensional case, that would mean that we have some kind of anti-ferromagnetic ordering in the system, which would make
a random system.
So it's not a lattice, and indeed, I can't tell you that it's a perfect transition. But it is a very large system. The grains are more very. It won't be a perfect anti-ferromagnet. Is that what you mean?
Well, if it is random, you should have at least some glassy stuff in spin system.
Sure, maybe.
There should be some of them which are not frozen and like that.
Well, okay, maybe. Right, sure.
So is it clear that the company is anti-ferromagnetic?
Well, if it was a perfect lattice, so it would be perfect anti-ferromagnetic because you know, you have dipole-dipole interactions. You know, a tail of one wants to repels a head of the other, and so
there's
you have.
No exchange itself.
Well, so this is a model that takes into account the model here takes into account dipole-dipole interactions without any exchange. Of course, you know. I don't know. Okay, signs that something is happening around these temperatures of 10 or 8 degrees, we see from another two experimental measurements. One of them is this measurement here, where we measure the hysteresis as a function of temperature. Okay, so as I said, the blocking temperature is somewhere around here, 22. And we start seeing a hysteresis, but at a certain temperature here, the temperature is around 8 or 7 degrees Kelvin, you see a sharp increase, maybe a change of the slope of hysteresis as a function of temperature. So something magnetic seems to be happening on around these temperatures where we see this rapid increase in times of relaxation. Okay? That is one thing. And the other thing that I'll mention here is something that is related to the glass, and that is the fact that when we look at the width, where the width here is defined as a you know, full width at half maximum, as a function of temperature. In all of the samples in the past, this width became larger as the temperature was increased. But in this nickel, it also becomes larger as the temperature is increased. But there seems to be some kind of discontinuity, a very, very rapid decrease of the width, you know, around this temperature where we see this interesting thing. So apparently, it looks like something special is happening at temperatures of 10, 7 degrees Kelvin, which does a few things. First of all, it affects the hysteresis of the conductivity in a special way. It has a large effect on the times. It increases the times by a lot of the relaxation. And it also affects, in a discontinuous way, the shape of this memory bit. Okay, so far everything has been at zero magnetic field. And now we would like to, we saw that at zero magnetic field, at some temperature, we jumped from something of the order of 1,000 seconds to something of the order of 6,000 seconds. So an increase of half of an order of magnitude, which is very dramatic, but things become even more dramatic when we put, when we apply a magnetic field, even a small magnetic field. So here's a magnetic field of 0.4 Tesla. And suddenly, the time shoot up to 66,000 seconds in this case. So unbelievably long times here. This, I remind you, this is just the half time. In order to erase the dip in such a sample, we would have to wait months, probably. But there's a very, very sharp increase of the times as a finite magnetic field is placed on the sample. Dramatic. So when we look at, again, the times, 1,000 seconds as a function of temperature for zero magnetic field and for a finite magnetic field, we see more or less the same transition. In this sample, it's about 10 and a half degrees. The blue is zero magnetic field, an increase of half an order of magnitude, and then applying a magnetic field increases the time by another order of magnitude. So magnetic field has a huge effect on the times in these ferromagnetic systems. Why am I not using this? Okay, so now what I...
The working time is the same as before.
Yes, in all of...
Which is not that different.
Right. It's not that different. Basically, as far as we can say, it's the same.
And I mean, it's only...
Yes. It's not. It's the same waiting time. Same preparation time. Okay, so now I want to walk you through the dependence of these times as a function of magnetic field. I think this is going to be important, and yes?
So empirically, you know it's an anti-ferromagnet?
No.
So if you look at the magnetic hysteresis, there's no indication?
No.
If you change magnetic field, not gate voltage, you have the same order of magnitude of time. Say, if you would switch magnetic field from 0.4 to minus 0.4.
No. That's what I'm going to show now.
Okay.
We haven't done it the way you suggest because, you know, everything here is a problem. The history really, you have to, if you want to say something definite, you have
it's
to make sure.
It's only for us.
No. What?
It's only for you.
If I would like to say something definite, I really have to make sure that the history until the point that I'm measuring is the same. And so I can't really grow something grow a dip and then change the magnetic field from one point to the other and say something conclusive because it would mean a different history. And I don't want to go into that, that mind bomb.
I don't understand. Before you, for the blue points, you claim that they could be antiferromagnetic, well, some kind of order, but then with the magnetic field, they point in the perpendicular direction, or is not enough for that? Once you apply the magnetic,
yeah, they point in the perpendicular direction.
So there is a different transition when they point.
So you know there's a difference, and I will get back to this. This is this zero magnetic field that I'm showing here is before I even started applying. This is the virgin curve. I'll get back to that. It's before I even started applying magnetic field to the system ever. Yeah. The randomization, is the way I understand it, is in the plane.
Yes.
So it's not anti-ferromagnetic like a two-dimensional anti-ferromagnetic. It's more random.
So with the field, what do you think
field,
it would happen?
With the field, I think we...
Same temperature.
What?
Why at the same temperature there are like two types of very different kind of transitions?
Just like we see, it's similar to what we see in the conductivity. Okay, in the conductivity there's a virgin curve and then there's a curve after you've applied the magnetic field. The resistance, the maximum resistance in the virgin curve is lower than the resistance in the curve. And I told you why I think this happens, because until you apply a magnetic field, the easy accesses lie in the plane. Okay, and then you have randomization, but you have randomization of angles. But once you align everything out of the plane, so you really have something which is more like an anti-ferromagnetic behavior, more like. Okay, by the way, unlike what happens with temperature, so with magnetic field, the width of the nothing happens to the width. So even though there's a huge change in powers, the width remains the same. Okay, so now what I'm going to do, something a bit different than what Boris suggested, is try to see what happens as a function of magnetic field, but preparing the sample each time again using the same protocol. So what we do after each of the steps that I'm going to show, we heat up the sample to a temperature where everything is raised fast, 25K. We leave it there, we erase all of the memory, then we cool it back down at zero magnetic field to the base temperature. And then we apply a magnetic field and measure tau. And then we do the same. We reduce the magnetic field to zero, we erase all the memory, cool it back down and apply a different magnetic field. Okay, that is the protocol that I'm going to use. So that now we can compare, now that I can compare the times for different magnetic fields. That's the only thing I can do. So what we see is something like this. Let me go through this again. So this is the kind of the virgin curve where everything has been erased, magnetic memory has been erased. We start with a zero magnetic field. We start applying a magnetic field, times become larger. Okay, so each one of these points is not a continuous, okay, after we did this, we heated it up, we cooled it back down, we applied this magnetic field. Took it back down, heated, cooled, and then applied this magnetic field. This is the way we do it. Okay, so what we see is a function of magnetic field is there's an increase of times in magnetic field up to about, in this case, 26 seconds, and it peaks out, and then it drops back to a lower value. And then coming back, okay, there's hysteresis with magnetic field. So this point, for example, is something that we've heated up, cooled down, applied a magnetic field, took it back here, and then measured tau. Okay, and what we see is a hysteresis, which is very, very similar to the hysteresis in the resistance. Okay, this is the Virgin curve, which kind of resembles this blue curve in the resistance. And when we come back on the red curve, after we've applied a magnetic field, we've aligned all of the spins in some direction, it really peaks to the high values that I talked about before. And this kind of mimics this behavior of the conductivity. So there is some kind of mimicking of the behavior of conductivity in the transition times. But notice that, as we said before, the effects here are of the order of a percent in conductivity. The effects on the relaxation times are orders of magnitude. So definitely there is some kind of behavior that resembles what happens in conductivity, but it is definitely coming from different parts. And maybe I'll conclude with this. If any of us needed any signs that that resistance and relaxation come from different parts of the system, different grains of the system, I think this is a very nice realization of that. For these two cases, we take a sample and we change its disorder so that we reduce the resistance by an order of magnitude. We're changing the resistance by an order of magnitude. And when we do that, we look at the times. And the times behave more or less the same, except for the shift in temperature at which this increase occurs. A 3 megaohm sample and a 300 kiloohm sample behave more or less the same. So resistance is changing an order of magnitude, but the relaxation times are not changing at all. Okay, the relaxation time does not depend on disorder. Does not depend on the resistance of the sample, or hardly depends on the resistance of the sample. On the other hand, magnetic field, when we apply a magnetic field on the sample, we reduce the conductivity by a percent or 2%. But we have two orders of magnitude, or close to two orders, an order of magnitude and a half in relaxation times. Again, telling us that resistance and relaxation times are coming from totally different parts of the sample, and the conductivity, if you have some kind of magnetic ordering, the backbone of percolation of conductivity may be able to bypass this by finding grains which are aligned, but the relaxation, which depends on the entire sample, has to go through all kinds of grains which are misaligned, and this probably affects the relaxation by a lot. So I think exactly on time, I'm going to end. Yes.
So the peak of this time is at 0.2 Tesla?
Yes.
Does this depend on the resistance of the sample?
Yes. We haven't, I'll say again. Okay, this, I don't want to disturb you with experimental problems, but this measurement is about a month of measurement. Each one of these measurements is a few days. So we don't have a lot of these curves. I think this is the only one I have.
Which one was the red is probably the more resistant one?
No, it's the same sample. This is going in one way, this is coming back. It's the same sample.
Then if you change the resistance?
So I haven't done this whole curve. I don't know where the hysteresis is going to be. But I assume that it will follow more or less the same as the hysteresis of the conductivity. But I can't tell you that. Yes.
Yeah, I wonder if you have any experiments not based upon measuring of resistance, measuring of magnetic properties directly, any glass experiment?
No.
No.
And the reason is, that's a good point. What we can do, the only thing that I can do in this system, since I cannot take the system out and measure, and this is something that we would like to do, it's all a matter of what is more important, is to measure anomalous Hall effect. These samples show a large anomalous Hall effect, which is related to magnetization. And I would like to see the slow relaxation of that anomalous Hall effect. that is on the agenda.
Nevertheless, you do believe that all glass effects are connected to magnetic properties.
I think the ones that I showed, the slowing down of the times, I believe that are related to magnetic properties. But the magnetic properties may be the electromagnetic properties, not, you know, it has to do with the electronic properties because it shows up in the memory dip. And the memory dip is something electronic. Yes?
I just want to clarify. So without a magnetic field, the magnetic moments of the grains are in plane or perpendicular also on the...
So it depends without magnetic field when. As the as-prepared sample, the virgin, before magnetic field is applied, we think and we have we have evidence to believe that most of them are lying in the plane.
But then why are you speaking about antiferro? Because then the sign of dipole-dipole interaction is not
true. Right. So in that case, antiferromagnetism, if there's any antiferromagnetism, it's much weaker. It's not still, you will have more antiferromagnetism than you would have if the sample was totally random. But and that might affect a bit. When we apply a magnetic field.
Right, I mean, so sine is, in average, it's zero.
Still.
So in one direction, they want to be ferro, another antiferro.
Yes, but if, sure, right. There's still a difference between that for transitions. There's still a difference, I believe there's still a difference between a case where everything is random and you have random angles between the sample, and if you have stripes of spin up and spin down, and you have to transition between them also, okay? You might that would still be a much slower process, even if it's not antiferromagnetic, totally antiferromagnetic. But you have many of them which are totally misaligned with each other. I think that would increase the times by a lot. It is not the same case as being totally random.
Okay.
Yes.
I said that the resistance and the peak in the resistance and the peak in the magnetic field are roughly the same place, right?
But I wouldn't count my, yes.
The resistance changes much, much less than the time, than the tau.
Much, much
so,
less.
But the resistance just depends on finding the best percolation cluster.
I didn't say that that the point here and the point here are exactly the same. I wouldn't say that. I actually don't know. Because
roughly the same.
Okay, you know, roughly it can be a factor of two.
Well, what I'm asking is basically that the relaxation time depends on going between different minima, and you have to invert a very large number. You have to change a very large number of particles.
Yes.
And therefore, the number of particles goes into the exponent, basically, and so it can be affected much more strongly than the resistance.
But what defines the hysteresis? What defines the hysteresis is the average size of the grains that act in all of these multiple processes, because this, if it's a super paramagnetic behavior, I mean this. It's much more complicated than that. The peak here will not depend on the number of transitions that you have to make, but on an average size of some kind of hole, size of grains. So I'm not sure that they should be different in that respect. Yes.
Can you come back for that dependence of the half width on temperature? This one. So if I just look at the data for the high temperature. Okay?
Yes.
Well, presumably that magnetic stuff does not enter anymore into this business. If I extrapolate that to absolute zero, what will I get?
A finite value.
It's above zero, right?
Yes.
Is it for something?
What Tzvi was, if I would plot this,
the question is for
extrapolating this curve to zero.
It does not extrapolate to zero.
It does not extrapolate to zero. It extrapolates to some kind of finite value. But you know, who knows? Because you know, something happens.
I don't understand your answer to me. Do you think that your memory dip is result of resistivity, not result of magnetic properties? What's driving force or Blasi effect in your sample? How do you understand it?
I think it's an electronic. It's an electronic effect.
It's not magnetic.
It is affected by the fact that the electrons are polarized, are magnetically polarized, and they have to hop from one grain to the other. When they have to hop from one grain to the other, they have to take into account the spin.
Of course, if you measure conductivity, it's this way.
But
if you would measure just magnetism, what will be?
So I haven't done that.
You expect that this is actually driving force.
I think you don't need that for what I've been saying.
You show the data above when magnetism becomes appreciable. You still see this effect. It only changes magnitude and changes shape as it goes to lower temperature, but it exists even above that. That's what it shows you. Above that certain temperature, it does not behave differently than other materials. That's the point. I think that was not clear.
Say it again, please. So you have a region where magnetic properties is absent, and still you have glass effect.
Yes. Yes.
It's very important.
It's not that the magnetic, I'll be more exact. It's not that magnetic properties are absent. They are different. Okay?
Different.
It's a super paramagnetic, which means that we see magnetoresistance, which is ferromagnetic. Okay, I'll try to say that again. There is a region where something magnetic changes in the sample. One of these things that changes is that the grains, first of all, high temperatures are super paramagnetic, so they don't have average of time they don't have magnetization, and below a certain temperature they do have magnetization. In both regions we see a memory dip. But the memory dip, or the times of the memory dip, are very different very different between this region and that region. That is the claim.
Let me ask a question again. If you just focus on the data at high temperature, above the things where you start having this nice effect with magnetic field and so on, in what way your results are similar to other systems, and in what way they are different? High temperature.
So they are similar in the rough time scales. Okay, they are probably similar in the shape of the memory dip and in the temperature dependent to some degree.
I see one difference is the one that I pointed out.
Yes,
this
but I don't want to extrapolate to zero because something happens on the way.
Okay.
But the fact that the width depends on temperature and decreases with temperature is something that everybody sees.
Maybe I missed it, but what is the distribution of grains in size?
You didn't miss it. We don't really know, impossible. It's really impossible for us to measure that or to look at these samples, because when we heat them up, we change the morphology. So that is an unknown. We can estimate the average size. We know the average size,
from the picture, right?
So that was a picture that was taken out of the system. It's just for illustration. It's not. We can't extract any quantitative.
So
it's about something of the order of 2 to 5 nanometers.
So what would be charging energy? If it would be
in the sky.
In the sky.
Yes.
You mentioned that you have experimental evidence that at zero magnetic field the spins lie in the plane.
So I said we have experimental so what we did for one of these samples, it's all of these indications. What we did for one of these samples is the same sample that I showed here, that we took it out.
Mm-hmm.
When we took it out, we could rotate the sample in and without, and there was a big difference between applying a magnetic field parallel and perpendicular. I'm trying to remember what it was. This was 15 years ago, but I think from that sample, which is similar to these samples but not exactly the same, we could extract the fact that when you apply, so the exactly this point. When we apply the magnetic field in the plane, the virgin curve and the hysteresis curve looked about the same. So I think that was a...
I mean, that just connecting your statement, I think it's very different dipole-dipole interaction in plane and dipole to the plane. The dipole to plane is clearly anti-ferromagnetic. In plane, it's ferromagnetic.
Yes, it's so with a caveat of what Boris said. It's clearly anti-ferromagnetic, but it's distorted. It's not a lattice. So.
But I mean that grains should have their own magnetic anisotropy, so it's hard to expect that anisotropy will be aligned.
Right, but
that's why I mean.
It's not, but this is not bulk nickel. These, maybe I should have said that, but these grains are kind of pancakey-like shaped. Okay, the shape anisotropy favors the grains to be in the plane.
So you mean it's not spheres?
It's not totally spheric. So the size, as I said, as I told Boris, is about is something between 3 to 5 nanometers, and the average thickness is about 1.5. So they are not really spheric. They look more like pancakey. The shape has a big effect, probably larger than the crystalline anisotropy. Okay, thank you.